You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 25th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Associate Professor at Seattle University School of Law, Dean Spade, author of Mutual Aid, Building Solidarity During This Crisis, and the Next. Also on the program, a year after George Floyd's killing, no police reform legislation to sign. Blinken is in Israel meeting with Netanyahu, vows relief to rebuild Gaza after Israel bombed it, and wants a consulate in Jerusalem. DOJ is fighting the full release of a memo shielding Trump from prosecution. And down the Hill and at the White House, the infrastructure talks with the Republicans on the brink of collapse. And that's good news. New variant found in India, spreading now in Britain. Texas poised to allow unlicensed carrying of handguns by just about anybody. Debt limit suspension deadline looms. The real question is, will it kill the filibuster? And good news for me. New York schools will be going full time in the fall. Also, good news for other people. It's the largest school district in the country. Florida becomes the 23rd state to sabotage workers as their unemployment benefits are slashed. Lastly, D.C. Attorney General files an antitrust suit against Amazon. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Emma, how are you today?
I am well. I am well. How about you, Sam?
I am also well. As you'll note, my voice is returning ever so slightly. I have not cleared out all the pollen that apparently has been resting in my throat, but I certainly feel better and voice is getting a little stronger. That's good news. And I have to say, I am buoyed by the idea that we are very close. I think the deadline for the infrastructure bill was in about a week, but we're already starting to see activity on the Democratic side preparing for taking this infrastructure bill through reconciliation. So we get more legislation passed, more spending passed, and really, frankly, investments in making the country more durable and sustainable. We have a lot more to go, but you know, this dance with the Republicans has been about as fruitless as one could imagine. They started, just to give you an update, the last time we were talking about this, really in any measurable way, Shelley Morcapito, I guess, and they were throwing around numbers, like what they would respond to the $1.9 trillion infrastructure bill that Biden was proposing. And they started saying things like maybe $600 billion, maybe $500 billion, maybe $700 billion. Their latest offer is $200 billion. They have literally lopped off two-thirds of their initial proposal in terms of what they were going to negotiate with Joe Biden with. Joe Biden countered the other day with $1.7 trillion. So they are $1.5 trillion apart now. Republicans are going to come back one more time, but hopefully we have now satiated the gods of bipartisanship who apparently need the Democrats to do a dance with the Republicans for weeks on end, knowing that the Republicans are just going to sit there and sort of rock back and forth. It's like when I was like really bad, you know, school dances, like in elementary school where, you know, the half the kids just sit there on the sides, just looking at other kids.
Yes,
dances.
Sure.
And then the other half just sit on the dance floor, just sort of rock back and forth. That's what basically what the.
Well, I mean, so, Biden's like weakening the bill by giving a blood sacrifice to the bipartisanship gods, essentially, right? Like he, you know, slices his hand, bleeds, says, will you take this? Will you take this? And then, no, I mean, we're lucky they're so extreme. We're lucky they're, you know, negotiating with essentially a phantom. That's helpful for Biden's purposes, even though, of course, you know.
Well, I mean, that's true. Let me just say this.
Yes.
That was the thing that saved Social Security during the Obama-Biden years.
Obama was like, let's do it. Let's do it. Let's privatize it. Yeah.
Well, it wasn't so much privatized.
It was
cutting the coal is essentially recalculating the cost of inflation for adults. And so the fact that the what we called them Tea Party, or they're just the Republicans, said, no way. That's what saved Social Security. And within a year or two, you had the Democratic caucus in the Senate voting to increase Social Security. But this is a Capito in April. Here's a quote. She was asked why $600 to $800 billion was the sweet spot. And she said, this is in April. It's just a ballpark figure. It may not even mean that much. I don't know. I just kind of threw it out as a talking point. They're not serious is the bottom line. And so the quicker we get through this stage, the better. They will pass the $1.9 trillion. They're going to have to go through reconciliation, which is going to take a little time, but we'll see that. I would imagine now by mid-July. And then at the end of July, we're going to see we're going to get to the debt ceiling. I know folks remember this from the Obama years. It only comes up during Democratic presidencies. I mean, it literally comes up during all presidencies, but we only talk about it in the news because it only becomes an issue when the Republicans are don't have the presidency. That's when they start to vote against it en masse. We borrow money, essentially put it on the functional equivalent of a credit card, except for we also own the credit card company as a U.S. government. And there is a pro forma, essentially, vote to raise the debt ceiling, which allows us to pay off the bills that we have incurred, essentially. Or allows us to take on more debt, which allows for the expenditures that we've already expended. This will come up at the end of July. It is extremely close in the Senate. Folks know this. And so that may be where we see the filibuster reform on the must pass legislation of raising the debt ceiling. Now, there's other things that could be done. But conventional wisdom is that we need to pass this bill without going insolvent, without the U.S. defaulting on its obligations for the first time ever on treasuries. And so that could very well be when we see the filibuster get modified, nuked, we're not sure. That could be the moment. And so they're going to want to get this infrastructure bill out of the way. Then we go into hopefully a filibuster-free period of time. It's possible. pass some more legislation, like, for instance, hopefully the we will see some police reform bill sent to Joe Biden. And hopefully, although I would imagine highly unlikely, it will be even remotely sufficient. But here is Brian Kilmeade on the anniversary of the killing of George Floyd. Here is Kilmeade sort of saying that, you know, sometimes it's not the crime, but rather the response, which is really the danger to society.
19 children in Minneapolis have been shot this year, an increase of 171% over the same period in 2020. The relatives wonder where the protesters are. Why ain't nobody mad about a 10-year-old, my grandson, fighting for his life, asked Cherie Jennings. Also another grandmother at May 17th mayoral event, because a cop didn't shoot him. That is the answer. So right now, as horrific as George Floyd's death was, our reaction's been worse.
Brian, let me tell you right now what's amazing. The George Floyd death was horrific. But what is amazing is all this crime in Democratic cities. The biggest mouths who are complaining about this racial injustice in Democratic cities, where people of color are running the government. You have black on black crime. You have attacks on police officers. And where's Al Sharpton? Where's Black Lives Matter? Do you ever see them when there's black on black crime?
There it is, of course, the problem with George Floyd's killing by the state, by the people that we pay to supposedly keep people safe. The real problem with that is that we now have black on black crime.
It's like so lazy. They've been doing it for same black on black crime. I mean, decades at this point. This is what the talking point's been, and it doesn't matter that violent crime, I think recently there has been some sort of spike, maybe due to the fact that people were in economic desperation, at least in the short term, but on the whole, on the average, has been on the decline for many, many years, murders, etc. The Democrat cities, the Democrat-run cities don't get credit for that. When that happens, it's only just, you know, to gin this up.
Well, and if folks are so concerned there, I would suggest let's reorient the police to where their only job is to solve murders. Let's put it that way. We can start with there because we have, you know, only about 20% of the murders in this country are actually ever solved anyways. But it is an interesting take. Not interesting, but it is, like you say, a banal take that they have they deploy all the time. Which is, why are you complaining about the fact that we have the paid agents of the state killing people needlessly? Why are you complaining about that when there's other people killing other people? That is what that breaks down to. Idea that we could do anything materially about violence amongst civilians without first addressing the fact that the people who are supposed to protect civilians are actually responsible for killing them. I mean, good luck with that.
Yeah, the increase in the crime rate could be troubling. Also troubling is the increase in the things that lead to crime rate. And we should address those.
Indeed. I mean, and look, I'm quite convinced that COVID itself, the going through a pandemic is bound to have these type of like sort of knock-on effects, which isn't to say that it's a good thing, it's a bad thing. But we clearly, the millions upon millions of dollars spent on the police obviously are not having any impact. And so that's, we need to reform the police in some fashion. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a moment. We'll be talking to Dean Spade, associate professor of law at Seattle University and author of Mutual Aid, Building Solidarity During This Crisis and the Next. We'll be right back after this. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. This is where we often have ads, not always, but sometimes. We don't have any today. If you want to get this podcast without any advertisements, become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. You get it ad-free. If you want the extra content that we do every day, become a member. You can do so at jointhemajorityreport.com. If you want to just support the show, become a member. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Ads help us, but they're never going to be in any way a even remote replacement for support from our members. It gives us the ability to say to some ads, no, we don't do ads for gig outfits. We don't do ads for finance. We don't do ads for companies, even if we like them, that we find out are doing business in the West Bank. Sorry, yep. It's a bummer. It's a huge bummer, but we just had to drop an advertiser. If they change their practices, we'll welcome them back. That would be the best case scenario. But so it's your support that makes it possible. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, we have a Discord now. At majoritydiscord.com. Totally free. Sign up, join, check it out, have conversations. We have over 3,000 people there now who are engaging in the conversation during the show, after the show. So check it out. All right. Want to welcome to the program Dean Spade, associate professor at Seattle University School of Law, author of Mutual Aid, Building Solidarity During This Crisis and the Next. Dean, I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start more or less how you do in the book with defining mutual aid. What is it and what is it not?
Yeah, mutual aid is just a term for talking about the part of social movement work where we are directly supporting people's survival needs based in a shared understanding that the systems in place are not going to show up to do that. And we need to kind of take care of each other. And actually those systems have caused the crises we're in often, whether it's environmental crisis, housing crisis, the crisis of policing and imprisonment, et cetera. And what it's not, I would say, is it's really a term distinguished from charity. The charity framework is really common in our culture. It kind of goes back to, you know, European Christian ideas that rich people can buy their way into heaven by making alms to the poor. And charity is kind of what our social services framework is based on. It's based on the idea that we should kind of hand out small band-aids to people who those who are giving it out decide are deserving. So it tends to be pretty system sustaining. It's like, oh, you're not sober, you can't get this housing. You don't have kids, you can't get it. You're undocumented or you have a criminal record. It's kind of, it reifies the stigma in our culture that says that people who are on the bottom deserve to be there, and we'll just pick out the ones who deserve to be elevated. And it doesn't do anything about the root causes. It just kind of like keeps putting the band-aid on. So charity and mutual aid are very different because mutual aid is about collective action and about imagining a world in which people are not in this crisis and that nobody deserves to be without a home or criminalized or whatever it is. And so it's a really important distinction because one is about collective action and the other one is kind of about sustaining the system and kind of good PR for the system and for rich people.
Yeah, I mean, that's I think the collectivism is so key to understanding it, right? Because so much of the philanthropic infrastructure is built on, you know, wealthy people's ego trips, for lack of a better word. Can you just talk about how that dynamic of allowing just rich people to willy-nilly throw money at something as opposed to, say, taxation and choose to pick and choose what they want to support and if that's even effective, just contrast that a little bit more with mutual aid.
Yeah, I mean, our legal system of having tax-deductible donations, the 501c3 tax system that establishes nonprofits sets up the way our philanthropy works. And it's just as you say, it's that rich people can keep their money out of the tax system and then put it towards their favorite pet causes, which isn't mostly stuff that involves poor people. It's mostly like the opera or my university or my favorite right-wing charity or whatever it is. And so most of that money just gets kept out of the tax system, and they actually don't even have to spend it. They can keep it in their big pile. It's got their name on it. It gives them prestige. And then they only have to spend out a few percent a year. They can also give kickbacks to their cronies by having like trustee fees to their favorite uncle or cousin. So there's all these ways in which the philanthropy system is actually about rich people keeping their money and not having to get taxed on it. And then when they do give it out, or when it does make its way through to, you know, organizations that are trying to do some good, they really get to decide what those organizations do. They're going to fund the ones that have an idea about change that they like, and they're going to not fund the ones that they don't like. So it keeps rich people in control in some ways of the horizons of possibility there. And they're not going to fund stuff that's a threat to their own well-being, right? To their own, their ability to maintain wealth. And so what issues are popular or unpopular and what gets funded is determined by rich people's horizons. So a lot of us who are seeking bigger, deeper social change are aware that it's unlikely to come through things funded by that system. Whereas mutual aid work is mostly and always has been people volunteering, right? People, we've seen so much of this during COVID-19, but it's much longer than that. It's people just deciding to support and care for each other and help make sure that people survive while they're working on the root causes questions. A really good example that a lot of people are aware of is the Montgomery bus boycott, right? That moment is such a key moment in social movement history in the United States. A lot of people associate it with like famous speeches by Martin Luther King, because in our society, we kind of focus on those charismatic figures. But actually, if you really think about what the Montgomery bus boycott required, it required tons and tons of people to coordinate rides for tons and tons of people. And a lot of that work, not surprisingly, was done by Black women, right? So the underlying thing that makes that strategy to get at the root causes of segregation successful, right? And particularly to try to really uproot the possibility to build people power that says you can't run the system this way anymore, comes not from those famous speeches, but from all this coordinated labor of ordinary people that they were doing for free. And so that's very, very different than the philanthropic idea that, you know, somebody will graduate from a business school with a great idea of how to solve poverty, and then a rich person will fund them, and then that will end poverty. Like that sort of fantasy, that very elite fantasy, I think doesn't hold a lot of water.
To extend out on that, the example of the Montgomery bus boycott, right? I mean, the mutual aid supported the action. And so the sequencing there is, we're going to do this bus boycott. You know, Rosa Parks is going to go on. She's going to refuse to go sit, and she's going to choose to do that. And then we're going to follow a legal strategy here. But we also need to be able, I mean, this is almost like the equivalent of a strike fund on some level, right? I mean, it is, but how does this sequencing work? Like, I understand as a support mechanism and providing the sort of like the durability and the sustainability of an action that is protest or is, you know, I mean, I guess all of these actions on some measure or another are a protest, right? But the sequencing and how does mutual aid protest or affect the system when it is not in support of another action? When it is just sort of like, obviously there's material benefits. We're going to talk about that a little bit, but in terms of like what it does, is it just the act of that organizing and setting it up for a future act, or what is it?
That's a great question. Yeah. So, because mutual aid isn't always like tied to one specific campaign, like in the Montgomery bus boycott, mutual aid is something people are just kind of always doing to get by, particularly in communities and populations that have consistently been left out of basic needs and basic infrastructure. You know, like Black people have always had to do mutual aid to survive in the United States, Native people, queer and trans people, et cetera. So it's kind of just ongoing. And I like the way you said it. I think it's really about, oftentimes when we're doing mutual aid of that kind, where we're just like, wow, people are unhoused in our community. They're living in the park. We're bringing them stuff. We're, you know, what's part of what happens there is that people deepen their political engagement when they do this kind of work, and they come to understand the issues better. So if we're doing support to people who are living in the park near our neighborhood, we might come to find out, wow, I never thought about how this affects people with disabilities. And I also learned how being undocumented relates to having a hard time being housed. And I also began to think about, you know, you learn all these dimensions. Oh, wow, I never knew how the housing system actually works and why it's so impossible for low-income people to get housing, or what this is like for veterans. And so why does the VA not work? Like we deepen our understanding and we realize, wow, it's related to the transit system. And then there's a transit strike coming up and we all decide to go out to the transit strike march together, the people from the encampment and everyone who's supporting them. And then the cops want to sweep the encampment and we're like, you know what, let's surround the encampment. You know, so I think part of what happens with mutual aid is it's most people's on-ramp to social movement work, either because they're a person in need of aid and they're like, these people are giving it out. And they think there's something wrong with the system and not me. Awesome. They're inviting me to collective action, or because I'm so mad about what's happening. It happened to me, or people I love, or I saw it on the news. And I'm like, I want to be part of that. And then I go to do that work and I really expand my capacity for solidarity and to understand the root causes. And then then I'm swept up in like, wow, now there's a chance to go out and be on the front lines around that. Or there's a chance to back up something that I've learned is connected. So this is, you know, a lot of what mutual aid does is it operates as that on-ramp to political action because it's a space of political education just by its practice. And also because a lot of times in mutual aid projects, people are like, yeah, let's also do political education with each other. Let's have a little workshop together about disability justice, or let's talk about, you know, toxic masculinity in case it's showing up in our group, or people are working together. So they're also like, let's make this more inclusive for everybody here. So there's lots of ways in which mutual aid is often tied, like when you see street medics at the protests, you know, in the wake of George Floyd's murder, those street medics are directly supporting this bigger protest, you know, strategy or tactic. But also there's a kind of the ongoing mutual aid that sows a field of people who are ready to participate in the next thing and the next thing.
On some level, it is analogous. And I know that ultimately the vision that you're expressing here is more radical, but it does mirror what unions did in some fashion in the past, right? Which was, we're going to gather for, in the instance of a union, just because we work together and because we want to negotiate for some type of material benefit. But what it's going to do is deepen, it's going to politicize a lot of things.
Yes, I think unions are a great example because unions are about building people power at their best. I mean, you're right. And so they're about building people power. And so it's like, how are we going to get together and have people power? Unions do things like strike funds, but they also do things like in some places like childcare support for people who are the spouses of people working there, or they build a health clinic, or right, there's lots and lots of ways in which anything that gets a lot of people together to have people power against elite power, you know, mutual aid is going to be in there because people, when there's concentrated elite power, people are struggling with basic survival needs.
One of the aspects that you write about it in terms of what it does is it exposes the failures of the system. I mean, that may be a little bit more obvious to people, but just if you could for a moment, just explain in what context that happens, right? I mean, I guess like the most obvious one is like, wow, we didn't get, where's the support for, you know, in the wake of Sandy, a Superstorm Sandy, or, but there's other things that are more subtle that get revealed.
Yeah, I mean, I think COVID, that's so obvious, right? Like our government utterly failed to have meaningful, consistent support for all the people who lost housing and childcare and income, right? Like there was just so many people have become impoverished during this period. Meanwhile, of course, a few people have become incredibly wealthy. And so right. That tends to work, right? But yeah, so I think that, you know, I really like the example of the Black Panther Party's survival programs for this, because there's this really beautiful documentary about those programs in which there's this woman who talks about how her family went to get free breakfast when the Black Panther Party was doing free breakfasts, all, you know, lots and lots of different cities. And she describes how it was so destigmatizing to show up and be like, oh, you're not bad because you can't feed your kids. Actually, we're in a space where we actually think this is because of anti-Black racism, and we're going to get together and fight anti-Black racism. And the shift from feeling stigmatized for being poor to feeling power, people power, community power to say, no, this is wrong. Like that kind of the way in which the system's failures are being exposed, instead of if she, you know, her and her family had probably also gone to like welfare authorities and tried to get food stamps. And all of those processes are about saying like, are you good enough to have this? And are you eligible for our program? And have you done anything wrong? Or do we have to take it away from you? And constantly being, you know, verified. And the Black Panther Party's program and all, you know, all that, there's so many programs like that during the 1960s and 70s movements and ongoing, is saying the system is at fault. And so I think that's true with anything we do. If we're looking at, you know, there's so many unhoused people right now in the US, and there's encampments in all of our cities, and people are doing a lot of mutual aid in those encampments. And they're also trying to stop the cities from sweeping those encampments and policing them. And there's been some pretty big, you know, like $1 million sweep of Echo Park in Los Angeles in March. And, you know, these kinds of things are happening all over. That is just forcing to the surface this conversation about, like, why are people unhoused? What does this have to do with city policy? How is, you know, how are wealthy developers supported and corporations in our cities and not the people who are actually the most in danger of not being housed? You know, that, and why are we spending $1 million to have the police raid this encampment instead of spending that money on housing, which is the obvious need? You know, this, I think all of this comes to the surface very intensely in mutual aid projects because people are just really up close with how the crisis is being produced in individual people's lives and how many other options there would be for like government response or for a different approach that doesn't keep concentrating wealth.
Yeah. And I think a lot of this too is Sam briefly mentioned Sandy and just kind of, or whatever hurricane it might be, is because a lot of government responses to crises are about essentially just putting a stoppage in the leak in the short term and not addressing things kind of in a long-term way. Is a lot of your, you know, emphasis on mutual aid about building long-term systems in communities that can kind of sustain themselves over time, as opposed to just having, say, the federal government come in and without any really existing infrastructure attempt to do something that is largely impossible if you're approaching it from that way?
Yeah, I mean, I would argue, I'm so glad you brought up this, like hurricanes and thinking about disasters. I would argue that those disasters are created by the government, right? Like the failure to fix the levees in New Orleans or the failure to make sure people's housing is shored up for the kind of weather they're facing, not to mention the, like, you know, the fact that we still are contributing to climate change and the government will not reduce the things that are, that would actually make climate change, that would curb climate change, we're still building it, right? So if we see these crises as produced by the government, and then FEMA, when it shows up, you know, that when the federal government shows up to do emergency management, they show up late. They mostly, the government response is things like policing people, you know, shooting people on that bridge in New Orleans, you know, like it's the response is tends to be more militarized and less about saving lives or making sure people can evacuate or whatever. And then like in Sandy, they gave people loans. They gave homeowners loans to fix their houses. They're not giving people what they need. And then they usually give almost nothing to like renters or itinerant people. And so that, as usual with poor relief and disaster relief, you see like any relief that comes more likely to go to white people, more likely to go to upper class people. I also think about the campfire in California, Paradise, California in 2018. That fire was caused by PG&E, right? PG&E is this kind of like really big, you know, utilities company that that can't really maintain its structure well because it's really big and operating for profit, not to do a great job, right? Just how skinny can we make this, you know, how big can we make the profit margin? And then because of that, they cause fires. The first thing that the state of California does is pass a law that says that nobody can sue them, right? Like the first thing California does is protect PG&E, not the people who are facing the fire. And then they come and, you know, the cops evict people out of the Walmart parking lot who are still living there, who have nowhere to live. And people today in Chico and that whole area are still disproportionately homeless because of that fire. So the government doesn't do disaster relief. And if they do, it's usually just to move money around in ways that benefit a few corporations and sometimes you know, maybe wealthy homeowners. And so given all of that, I think it really shifts our idea to exactly what you're saying. Like, would we as communities want to put in place that would allow us to actually begin to try to prevent disasters and prepare for them? And I'm really relying on a lot of Naomi Klein's work to talk about this, you know, her work around disaster capitalism, because she's like, yeah, when the disaster comes, they just do things that benefit big corporations. And one of the things she talks about and a lot of other people are talking about as well, what would it look like to do things like, if we had a much deeper level of community participation, which I think for a lot of people starts with being part of a mutual aid project, we might get to conversations like, wow, I'd really love it if our community didn't use PG&E for our electricity. Could we do something with solar? Could we do something with wind? Like, could we have a mini grid that's not part of this really dangerous grid that PG&E does? Or could we be networked with other communities in our area in a way where it's more governed by our people? Or how do we want to do healthcare? There's a program in Oakland that I think is really useful. It's in a Black community where they've identified that if people call 911 around health issues, health emergencies, the police always come with the ambulance, and it's really, really dangerous for Black communities. And there's a lot of times that Black people get hurt or murdered by the police when they show up instead of getting the healthcare they need. And so this program called the Oakland Power Projects is deeply training people in that Black community to do emergency healthcare that includes mental health response, acute care like gunshots and things like that, and chronic care like diabetes and those kinds of health issues. They're like, we're just going to create our own way of meeting this health need because the way the government is offering us is so dangerous for the health of our community. So I think that's the ultimate vision for me of mutual aid is like, how do we move from kind of being passive participants and just having to accept the very like inadequate and harmful responses that are supposed to address our needs? And instead, like, let's make the responses that we think would help. Like, most of our cities and counties are not ready for the blackout, the earthquake, the storm, whatever's coming. Like, they're not. And they're not making sure that low-income people's housing is safe. And they're, you know, thinking about what happened in Texas last winter with the cold. Like, what would it look like if we decided as people in those communities to do deep emergency preparedness, assuming that the government isn't going to show up in a good way? They're probably going to show up in a way that's harmful or really uneven. And then we started to say, well, what would actually prepare us? And I think that given the conditions we're facing right now, the kinds of crises that are happening in all of our communities, from economic crisis to ecological crisis, we need to kind of be doing that. And I think COVID has brought a lot more people into that kind of activity.
I want to circle back to that for a moment in terms of like that role of government in a few. But when you look back in recent history, I mean, I guess as you were saying about the breakfast and Black Panthers and that notion where it destigmatizes and reorients the understanding of why someone's in a position of needing to get a breakfast for their kids or for themselves. Are there major systemic failures over the past, I don't know, 15, 20 years that you see that were missed opportunities where we didn't have mutual aid, which could have really, both from a material standpoint, but also in terms of a standpoint of a broader understanding that this is a systemic problem as opposed to like, oh, I made, you know, whatever. I should have taken that job way back when, and I'd have breakfast now. I mean, is there any that stand out to you?
You're talking opportunities? Missed opportunities for mutual aid responses. What I would say about that is that most often mutual aid responses happen at a very local level because that's often where disaster happens. So COVID is, I think the reason the idea of mutual aid has gone mainstream this past year is because COVID is kind of one of these rare disasters that happened everywhere at once, not evenly, but still, right? It's like the whole world had to deal with this. So the whole world was doing mutual aid. So journalists were like, wow, let's talk about this thing everyone's doing. It's really interesting. Whereas at every sort of site, you will see mutual aid popping up with every fire and hurricane. And the amount and capacity and depth of mutual aid people are able to practice often relates to like how deeply they already had community ties. Have they been doing baseline mutual aid already before the big storm or fire? So that's part of, you know, what I'm really talking about is how can we sustain mutual aid efforts so that when we respond, we don't, you know, burn out, or that also like we need a lot of people doing mutual aid because there's a lot of people in crisis. And so how do we have mutual aid projects that are capable of responding in the kind of quantity of the need? And I think this has been visible during COVID. So if I think about missed opportunities, I guess I would see, I think that mutual aid is always there. It's, if you look at any disaster, it's there. If you look at any point of crisis, including the ongoing kinds of crises, like living in the most imprisoning country in the world, there's just so much mutual aid towards prisoners, towards their families. And there's mutual aid everywhere where there is crisis. But we do live in a society that has pushed us intensely towards isolation. And I think that's worsened in the last, you know, especially with the age of the internet, more people live alone, more people don't have live connections to neighbors or in their communities. And people are suffering a lot because of that. So that makes it harder to do mutual aid if people don't know anybody and like don't, you know, people are moving a lot for jobs, like people are disconnected in a certain way. And so then your only safety net becomes 911, you know, that's kind of the result right of that. And I think also that level of trained passivity, like someone else should come and save us, you know, like that is really convenient to a system that doesn't want people super activated and asking questions with each other and saying things should be different. So I think that's like a pretty big historical arc. And I would say that comes after 1960s and 70s is a high point of mutual aid in, you know, think about like all the feminist health clinics. I mean, just so many, there was both bold, you know, revolutionary action happening and just tons of community mutual aid in, you know, at all the flashpoints in the anti-war movement, the anti-racist movements, feminist movements, et cetera, gay rights, et cetera. But then I think you see a pretty big backlash in the 80s. You see the Reagan administration, you see this, you see a new narrative and a new set of really dire economic conditions that we're still living under from the kinds of economic policies that were put in place that caused people to be more isolated, to have to work longer for less money, to have a harder time engaging in community work because they're barely getting by. And I think that we've been living off that. And now we're at this new peak where people are like, oh my God, disasters are abounding. We have to have each other's backs. And the system looks less legitimate because it's not meeting people's basic needs in such an obvious, painful way, kind of no matter who's president. And so I think we're seeing a new sweep of both bold resistance and mutual aid to meet these crisis conditions.
Having lived through the 80s, the ethos was very individualistic. Greed is good was not presented really with that much irony at that time, I should say. So let's just turn just briefly to, a big portion of your book is also a how-to manual. I mean, it is for people who are going to engage in mutual aid and some of the major pitfalls. The leadership aspect of it, you harken back to the Black Panthers as to some problematic leadership issues that they had, or at least the hierarchies or the mechanism. Talk a little bit about some of the pitfalls that people should be aware of as they engage in mutual aid.
Yeah. I mean, I think that a major concern is that we live in a culture that's based in hierarchy and where people go to jobs and have to either be like, try to be the boss of someone or like just kind of numb out and get bossed around. Like, and just, can I get by? Can I just do what this person says I have to do? And so we don't get very good at practicing the skills of being in a participatory space where everyone's a volunteer and you really want to have the wisdom of the group determine what we're going to do together. We don't just want to like steamroll other people and be like, you know, my way or the highway, because then they'll just leave and stop participating. So we need a really different like way of being together than the things we've learned at spaces like schools, often families and jobs. And so that's a really big piece. How do we understand leadership that produces mutuality and lots of participation from everybody versus leadership that produces like my concentrated power or yours, you know, and gets everybody else to kind of like go along. And that, I think what I talk about is how in regarding the Black Panthers and other groups in the 60s and 70s, that there was a really popular framework then of this, a certain kind of really hierarchical way of organizing groups. And there's a lot of downfalls to that. One, it often leads to people like to some degree or another abusing their power or just like not having the best idea, but their idea is the way it has to be because we've put them in charge. So that can be really hard. And that can mean people leave when they disagree and there can be really big splits. Also, there's a long history of law enforcement infiltration of our social movements that's still going on today. And it was very intensely targeted at the Black liberation movement in the 60s and 70s. And so if you have this very clear set of like who's in charge, you can either take those people down through assassination or arrest, or you can infiltrate and get one of your people in there. And the FBI did that a lot in that period. And so our groups are much more resilient and responsive if lots of people know how everything works and are deciding things together. Because then if something happens to any one person, the group still goes on and one person can't sell out or be bought off in some way to do something that's not aligned with the group, which is also a problem in terms of our like nonprofit world in which, you know, the philanthropist will pick off a leader and be like, we're going to make you our darling. And then now you're going to get paid and you're going to come work at the county or the city level. And then that person is like, it becomes very hard and confusing for other people in the movement. Like, is that person still our leader? Or they now belong to the kind of our opponents, you know? So ultimately the idea of having groups in which a lot of people are participating in decision making, and you do that in really thoughtful ways, which I kind of lay out methods for in the book based on things that have worked for lots of groups, allows more people to participate meaningfully and become really highly skilled at doing this, because we're all going to be, the rest of our lives are going to be full of disasters. So we're going to need to be responsive to a lot of different conditions. So we might be in a group to get today together about supporting people in our local jail. And tomorrow we might be in a different formation that's about people in, you know, struggling with homelessness. And we also might be responding to the earthquake that's coming in a few years. So we want as many people as possible, as skilled up as possible, to be in groups together, treat each other well, make decisions together, not try to be the boss of everything, and actually like move with group wisdom. And I think there's a lot of very feminist models for that. And in general, you know, there's a ton of global work that has showed us what those models are and work in the US. And I think more mutual aid groups have gone towards those like flat or horizontal instead of those hierarchical models over the years because they're more sustainable.
We got a question actually from a listener that I think works in well. This is from Chairman Meow. The greatest obstacles to carrying out mutual aid, at least in my neck of the woods, are all the technocratic and legal barriers between us, the volunteers, and the ability to move money and resources around to the people who actually need help. Setting up the right kind of 501c, figuring out how to decentralize banking, disentangling ourselves from profitable ventures. It's a mess. Collective action is fundamentally incompatible with neoliberal capitalism. I mean, how do you deal with that? Because there isn't, if I want to go and, you know, I don't know, start a pajama company, there's a whole roadmap that is well tread, pajama company, but where, you know, I can go on these endeavors, but in an endeavor that involves like redistributing wealth to people who need it, it's very complicated because our system's not set up for that. How do people get around that?
Yeah, I think I just want to, if your listeners are interested in this, I recently did a webinar with a tax law professor about this that people can find. It's called like Handling Money for Mutual Aid Groups, and the video's out there. And we made a little chart of like how to think about the pros and cons of different models. Like, yes, we want to get a 501c3 or no, we don't. Yes, we want to be fiscally sponsored by another org or no, we don't. Like, what are the pros and cons of each model? The basics is this is a really big issue facing a lot of groups right now because a lot of groups gave out tons of money in 2020, groups of people who'd never done this before. And then maybe they did it through Venmo or PayPal. And then suddenly they got a tax statement and they were like, oh my gosh, we took in all this money. And now whoever's name was on that account is being expected to pay, you know, 20 or 30% taxes on that. And they didn't keep that for money for that. Right. So that's been a problem that's often happened to mutual aid groups over the years. And I think we're seeing it at a big scale right now because of how much money moved in the last year. And that's why we did the webinar. I mean, I think that there's a lot of different ways people deal with that. One is to, so some groups think it's worth it to get a 501c3 status and be able to take in money as a nonprofit. But then you have like the surveillance by the government. You have to file a 990 form every year. You know, you end up with somebody has to be literate on all that. And lots of us just aren't, or lots of people aren't. Some groups decide to just do everything more informally. I mean, a lot of groups don't really move that much money. Like some groups move a lot of money, but a lot of groups are moving food or, you know, or just like, you know, childcare, things that aren't going to be taxed in that same way. Some groups, you know, working on things like if we give you the money by check or cash, it's not traceable in the same way. So can we get, if we're doing something locally, can we gather it without going through Venmo or PayPal? I think that, you know, it's like these rules are designed to make people not share, just to be real. They're designed, you know, like it's part of the system. And so we do have to be savvy about it. And also it doesn't have to be like a total block or obstacle, right? We can also do other things like, is it that you need an air conditioner? Can I buy you the air conditioner instead of sending it to someone's, you know, Venmo? I think that people, depending on whether you're working at a regional scale or a very local scale in a neighborhood, people have a lot of workarounds. And also then sometimes you just are like, oh no, someone's stuck with a tax bill. We have to raise money for it. And it's okay that we have to do that because we don't want someone to be punished for having done this beautiful work. And so I think that I just appreciate the question because it's good to notice that these systems are literally set up to benefit the richest people and to really make it hard for ordinary people to share stuff with each other, but it's not impossible.
I mean, I guess in that respect, just even organizing to do mutual aid fulfills that, I guess, part of the mission of mutual aid in terms of, you know, being able to see the structures that are set up and the political choices that are made in the context of those structures. All right. So lastly, let me ask you that your critique of the state, right, is that many of these issues are a function of the state's failures. This is as opposed to a right-wing critique, which would be like, we don't even want the state to try. Right. Like, are we just going to, this is going to be it. And We would like to freeze everything right now. We happen to have the land, the power, and this and that. So now's a good time to sort of like, let's have no government intervention. How much of this, so what does, I guess maybe this is a two-part question, but one is why, where does like the reform, like is reform of the government response to these things part of this programmatically, or is that like part of the journey to get to another place? And then the second part of that question is like, much of this is predicated on the failure of society to do what it should be. What does this look like in success? Like if the context was success, would we have mutual aid, or is that just going to be like not a thing anymore? It's just like the way that we live our lives.
So I would just say too, I want to add to your critique of the right, that the right also, they don't want a small state. They just want all the money going to police, military, right? They actually love a huge state.
Right.
That's a security state, which
to
makes
protect their property. Right.
Yeah. So it's, they're like, they love the state, you know, it made them, but they think they don't. Yeah. So I think that, it's important to distinguish my critique from like a libertarian, like right-wing libertarian critique, because mine is just kind of like realism. Like, okay, the US government, which is the one I live under, is like, has always been organized by white supremacy and colonialism. It has always, whenever it's done disaster or poor relief, it's given it out in a racist and sexist way. Like I would be silly as a scholar of, you know, the history of welfare to think that that's about to change. And these disasters are upon us. And so this is how we get by. And I think, you know, yes, I want a society that's run by mutual aid instead of run by concentrated elite power. So what I'm really thinking about here is like, rather than what we have as what the US government is it's like this thing that can redistribute. It helps extraction happen to the wealthiest people. That's its job. It's an extraction machine. And it does that through taxation to some degree, but it does it through like all kinds of ways of organizing so that everyone has to get their life through corporations and through, you know, have to get our energy through that. We have to get everything through these systems that we know are unjust and unsustainable, like our food system and our energy system, et cetera. And so what we want to do is replace those systems that are terrible, that rely on keeping millions of people in cages, that, you know, we want to replace that with things that we think actually work in our communities and that are locally based and participatory and deeply networked with each other and in solidarity. So that's what like success looks like to me. Success would not look like, if some people's vision of success would be that like we'd have a really nice mommy daddy taking care of us state that would give us everything with us having to just get to just passively. And that to me, that sounds like authoritarian control, right? It sounds like I know that whatever they would give out would have certain people in mind and not others, because that's how it's always been, especially with racism in the US, right? So what I'm interested in is like deep local wisdom and participation, so that there wouldn't be concentration of wealth, because people would actually be co-stewarding things like land, water, food systems, and we would do it in ways that weren't destroying the earth and making like workers sick and all of that. So it's really a vision of deeply participatory, non-passive engagement with the basic things that meet our survival needs. And it feels essential on an ecological level. And also it's about people actually having collective control over their lives, over which people have not had, in particular communities of color and Native communities in the US. It's a little bit abstract, but I think what I'm trying to say is like, for me, this is about a realism around the limits of our state form and what kind of white supremacist state the US is and how it's been about extraction. And so just stopping like, and along the way, we get concessions, right? The other thing I'll say is like, when movements rise up, there are concessions from the state. We should celebrate those as indications that we built power and had some victory, but they're always insufficient, right? The PPP loans don't meet Black businesses, right? Or we know they're all, the concessions of relief are always really insufficient. So we can say, great, there were concessions. That's a sign that we're building power. We're not going to go back to sleep now. We're going to keep building and actually try to build something that we think can be livable, which we're not at yet.
The book is Mutual Aid, Building Solidarity During This Crisis and the Next. Dean Spade, thank you so much for your time today. We will put a link to your book at majority.fm. Really appreciate your telling us about it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break and we'll be right back after this. So there you have it. That book, incidentally, is both, you know, there's a there's some history of mutual aid in there. There's the theory and a how to. And I don't know. You know, we had stuff going in our just in our apartment building, you know, for folks, you know, inviting older folks who couldn't necessarily go to the supermarket and purchasing them food and whatnot. This is one of those, you know, sort of projects that that are helpful along the way, that, you know, to a vision. I have some skepticism about, you know, sort of the without sort of like a state existing on some level. But, you know, that's everything along the way that is expressed in that context is helpful to society and diminishes, hopefully, the bad stuff that you get along with a state that has been captured or was established for some rather narrow interests.
Yeah, I mean, I think by, I guess, creating or incentivizing and just encouraging different projects that are going to reduce atomization in our communities, because, you know, that's, I think, an under-discussed problem, that project is moving us in the right direction, as you say.
Yeah. And it's not just the atomization. It is the lack of power that that comes with that atomization and pushback. But different era. We are no longer, fortunately, in the 80s and in the wake of the 80s, in the 90s, and then in the aughts, as it were. So hopefully we will see more of this, and we will see in those moments where we do have sort of crises, or, you know, whether they are acute or sort of rolling, we'll have a broader response that will fill that vacuum before moneyed interests do. All right, folks, that's it for us today. We will see you tomorrow if you are joining us on Peacock. And for those of you who are not, which is probably a lot more of you, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. Joining us today on the show will be Nomiki Kantz of the Nomiki Kantz Show. She will be joining us. Just a reminder, it's your support that keeps this program going. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Matt Lack.
Yeah. Oh, wait,
maybe we don't have Nomiki today. Is that possible? I hope she's okay. Well, Matt, why don't you tell us what's happening in the Matt Lackian universe?
So tonight I will be with my Twitch stream. I went out last night to celebrating my girlfriend getting accepted into nursing school. So I did not Twitch stream last night.
Congratulations.
Thank
you. Wait. She didn't want to Twitch stream to celebrate that she got into nursing school?
No, it turns out she'd rather go out on the town. I thought that was weird too, but I don't know.
Weird.
COVID's making everyone act in just all sorts of weird ways. So.
Yeah.
Did you, when she said, Matt, I want to go out on town, I don't want to watch you do a Twitch stream, did you say, like, I feel like I don't even know you anymore?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I mean, you haven't seen me play Rocket League in a while, so.
Right.
But we went bowling, actually, so it was fun.
No way.
Yeah, it's great. Tonight, yeah, I'll do a Twitch, twitch.tv/literary hangover. I'll probably play Rocket League.
There are some good bowling places in Brooklyn. I'm trying to remember, like, I've been to a few of them out here, and I just, like, there are divey ones, there are ones that are bigger, and I can't remember their names. Like, I can't believe that society existed before this time.
Well, there's Brooklyn Bowl, which is a concert venue, yeah, and sort of, like, fancy one. They've got locations across the country.
And my friend used to work there. Yeah. Here.
Oh, nice. And then you got the
gutter.
Gutter.
The Gutter. Yes, that's a good place.
Where's that? Williamsburg?
Yes.
I still, Matt, am disappointed that you didn't put up more of a fight. Like, this is the way that I celebrate, and I want to celebrate this.
I mean, to be fair, I got to watch basketball while bowling because they had the game projected right over the lane. So I was watching playoffs and stuff. So I wasn't exactly entirely for her.
Okay. Well, there you go. I'm glad to see that.
Who won, though? I mean, did your gaming prowess translate to the bowling lanes?
Oh, I'm a good bowler. I got over 100 a couple times.
There you go.
Pretty close every time. So.
All right. Well, really?
Yeah.
Well, you've also just got to have, like, when you have to have power through your legs when you're following through, too. So
he's got long arms. It's like you have to bend, and it just,
I can basically reach down the lane.
Rolls right off. It's not fair. Where's Nomi? Let's bring her in.
Oh, here she is. There she is.
I don't see her. Oh, there she is. We're just sitting here looking at Nomi's picture. Nomi!
Hang on. This happens so fast, guys. Wait!
Let's see. What else we got to go?
There we go.
You got to give me a second.
All right.
I just hear Nomi as soon as I'm like, hi.
Hi. Where are you located?
I am in a
doctor's office?
No. I'm in a hotel room. Just for today. And then I moved to a new location in San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Okay.
There you go. Still filming this documentary, and I will be for the rest of my life.
There you go. Well, it's it's nice to have a project that lasts your entire life.
As long as the money's flowing in, that's all I care about.
Nomi, what's happening with your show today?
We have Akayla Lacey on today talking about her article in The Intercept saying that Congress misses symbolic deadline for police reform. Of course, this is the anniversary of George Floyd's murder. And then later in the show, we have our amazing panel of, let me look at it just to make sure it's confirmed, because sometimes this stuff isn't confirmed by the time I'm on the show. Yes, we do have Ben Dixon and Simon Rode on, which is awesome because who's better than Ben Dixon and Simon Rode? Many
Maybe
people.
Maybe Akayla Lacey. That's about it. That's
well, she's... That's
folks can check that out at youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow.
Oh, look at you. Is it because the Fox News guy said my name wrong that now suddenly you've been embarrassed to say my name perfectly?
No, it's just that was just like, I don't know. It's really just like roulette. Just like
no, but you've been more consistent recently, I think.
Have I?
Those long limbs.
I've been
as long as he doesn't have to think.
Pronunciation.
Really trying to think about it. I'm like the Chuck Knoblauch of saying your name.
You even said Liz Cheney on the show the other day.
Yeah, Sam's got you got the yips or whatever they're called.
I don't get that joke. What's the joke?
Chuck Knoblauch's the second.
Is this a sports thing?
No, I got it. Chuck Knoblauch's the second baseman for the Twins, and then do you go to the Yankees?
And
he like stopped being able to make the throw from second to first base. He just couldn't
throw
make
the ball
it
from second base to first base.
It's
really
a mental
tragic
thing.
Yeah, but he just choked. He's just psyched himself out, and he couldn't throw the ball there. He would just like throw it over the head or throw it in the dirt. I mean, it was just it's not a very long throw.
Yeah, it was not a hard throw.
Besides the pitcher, sure. Probably the shortest throw to first that you can make. I mean, but he just couldn't do it. All right,
perfect analogy for my name.
For my ability to say
for your that abilities, yeah, but in yeah, okay, that's fair enough.
Fair enough. We will see you in the fun half, ladies and gentlemen.
You right are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ the Anarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
I'm the alpha males.
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Okay, I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! What? Come on! What? Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here!
I am a total pussy.